are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 10th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, independent journalist Dan Frumkin on the firing of James Comey, the Tuesday Night Massacre.
Firing the cock director.
Also on the program, we'll be talking to Luke Savage, writing in Current Affairs how liberals fell in love with the West Wing. Meanwhile, a state of emergency declared at a nuclear site on the West Coast. Have no fear, Rick Perry is on the case. Meanwhile, a grand jury issues subpoenas of Flynn Associates
dead
as a function of the FBI Russian investigation. Millions of dollars are pouring into college Republican groups, and a reporter arrested for yelling questions to Trump administration officials.
Gotta be respectful.
And surprise, surprise, remember Wilbur Ross's promises of 4% growth in GDP? Well, turns out they're going to be less than 3%. Heath Mello loses in his bid to become Omaha's mayor. U.S. arms the Syrian Kurds. And probably a lot more stuff that we can't even possibly get to. All that and more on today's program, folks. Yeah, it's another one of those, days, could be weeks, that we have become used to in the Trump era, which is just crazy-ass news drops late at night. We were lucky to get Frumkin. I pre-taped an interview with him just about an hour ago. We will have more guests on this topic as the days progresses, because this is a pretty big deal. What's also stunning, apparently, we'll go through a lot of the reporting, but Trump apparently very surprised at the backlash. The entire White House apparatus seemed to be completely taken off guard that, in part, that he was doing this because he sent his head of his personal security, which now has a, I think it's that bald guy. The guy.
Bo Deedle?
No, not Bo Deedle, but someone probably friends with Bo Deedle. I mean, he sent his the prefect of the guard. What do they call it in Roman times? Who would they have called that
Roman
guy?
Prefect?
No, the it's like the head of the legion that protects I can't remember who it is, but there's a specific name. I'm shocked. That's still
Rome isn't my thing.
It's a Swiss still, guard, man.
He's
what do I know?
Still recovering.
I'm
going
to get into Rome in my 30s,
but. Nevertheless, he sent his former head of his personal security guard, who now is working at something in the White House, to deliver the message to Comey, who, of course, was not in the office at the time. But none of the communications apparatus around the president seemed to be aware that this would be in any way controversial. I think maybe they thought, like, oh, everybody hates Comey. Why would anybody care?
Didn't you see this coming? I mean, a couple weeks ago, as soon as Comey kind of
was testifying. Essentially was like, yeah, we're looking at stuff.
Well, this is consistent with my theory that Comey was not in the bag for Trump, but rather when he announced, when he sent that letter to in October, that he was doing so because he was insulating himself and perhaps Clinton from criticism about going after Trump's team. And now we see subpoenas issued for Michael Flynn's associates. I mean, there's clearly, I don't know what it is, but there's clearly going to be more investigations in some quarters. But I think Comey was completely taken by surprise. And frankly, I am somewhat surprised only insofar as like this is so naked that it may be, you know, it pushes the ball forward in terms of Trump. I mean, there's a couple of, you know, we'll talk more about the implications of this, but the long and short of it is I think Paul Ryan is perfectly happy with it because this stuff distracts from the their agenda to destroy Medicaid as we know it and cut taxes for the wealthy. I think simultaneously, however, and, you know, we'll talk to Luke Savage about this a little bit. It does inject another level of intensity, of anti-Trump intensity, which could lead to the Democrats taking control of the House in 2018.
Look at that.
And yes, there's footage now of Donald Trump with Henry Kissinger. I got to say, it's the first time I've seen Trump look vibrant next to anybody. But put that aside. It will have this sort of paradoxical effect of getting even more resistance to Donald Trump. And we'll talk to Luke about that as well, because it is a sad but true reality that we live in. You can have, you know, we're going to need more votes that not less to defeat people in these House races. And a lot of people are not motivated by policy and, you know, the point of politics. Sometimes they're just motivated by politics. And we will get to that as we go forward.
We need to do a West Wing remake of the Trump White House. The same pretension and dialogue style, except with really stupid people.
Right. Right.
I just got off the phone with the Russian ambassador. Oh, yeah? Kislyak? Blah, blah, blah.
And there's so many different side stories here. This Rod Rosenstein, who presumably is well thought of. And you know, I get to this point with Dan. Look, Comey should have been fired. Barack Obama should have fired him because he broke on multiple occasions protocol and policy of the Department of Justice and FBI. You don't talk about ongoing investigations in that way. I suspect what we're going to see next is going to be another wave of leaks like we saw in the days, in the week and a half, that led to Jeff Sessions, Sessions' recusal. And I think we're going to see another like wave of leaks. So there go my, you know, attempts to go to bed early because it's all going to drop at like 10:15 at night for the next like 2 weeks until the Republicans agree to assign a special prosecutor. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see for that. Here is an update for you. What day was it last week that I got the flowers? Was it Thursday? Matt, were you here when I got the flowers?
No, then it was Friday.
Are you sure?
It was Friday.
I think I got them Thursday.
And Thursday.
Matt well,
just doesn't
nevertheless,
remember.
Well,
nevertheless,
I can tell you, the bouquet is rocking it. In fact, Nikki last night was like, those flowers are beautiful.
This bouquet is rocking it. I thought that's what she said.
Where did you get those? And I sort of pretended like I got them, you know. I said, I got them from florist. I wasn't going to tell her that Pro Flowers sent them to me to try out, see if they're good.
At the Korean market.
Well, I mean, why not take credit for it? Folks, when you send the 100 blooms for mom bouquet for pro flowers this Mother's Day, and Mother's Day is in, you got to do this right now. I think you can do it. I don't know how much lead time you need, but it comes with a free glass vase, which I couldn't get over, for $19.99. And if you want to make a statement, you want to kick it into high gear for your mom.
Of course you do.
You upgrade to a premium vase and include gourmet chocolates for just $10 more. And let's be honest, you're going to eat the chocolate anyways. Your mom's going to say, here, I'm going to have one, you have the other five.
She's going to mail it back to you?
Well, I guess that's true.
Yeah,
but aren't you going to go visit your mom for...
Well, maybe.
You're not.
No.
Choose the delivery date you want, and Pro Flowers are guaranteed to arrive fresh and beautiful and stay that way for at least 7 days or your money back. They, honestly, these flowers are gorgeous. Moms love fresh flowers. Everybody does, frankly. Saul is just completely obsessed with flowers. And he was going up and he was squeezing them like, these are not crispy. And then he went over to the other ones that had turned bad that we got somewhere else. And he's like, these make a crinkly noise.
You got a very astute kid on your hands there.
Yeah, it's true. Don't forget all the moms in your life, your mom, your grandmother, your wife, your mother-in-law.
My wife.
Seriously, you want to score some points, send some flowers to your mother-in-law. Don't even tell your other half.
Back
Just do it on your own.
Back channel it.
The only way to get 100 blooms for mom with a free glass vase starting at $19.99 is to visit proflowers.com, and then you click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and use my code CEDER, S-E-D-E-R, E-R, folks, not A-R. No C, it's S. Spelt like Seder, S-E-D-E-R. Proflowers.com, code CEDER. When you click on the mic, this stunning bouquet sells out fast. So order today, and you got to get it there before Mother's Day. So do it. Just do it right now. Also, I should say, if you're watching the show, you can see it's been a couple of days since I've been on Chris Hayes' program, and so I'm unshaven. Am I worried? Oh, Sam, what are you going to do if you get called today to go on? You got like half a beard. How are you going to shave? Oh, I know how I'm going to shave. And you know how I'm going to shave. Because I've been shaving this way for, what, like 3 years now?
Mm-hmm.
Harry's. For decades, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. So two guys, Jeff and Andy, they were fed up with getting ripped off. They started Harry's to fix shaving. God, to be
tired
young
of
again.
It. They were tired of getting ripped off by the big chains. So Jeff and Andy got together.
I wish I had that
different.
Level of motivation. It's just $2 a blade compared to four or more you'll pay at the drugstore. You know what I love about Harry's? I love that the blades are $2. But I also, I love the handle. I love the whole kit and caboodle, frankly. And I also have to say, I really liked it when they made the razor heads a little bit thinner because I've got some nasal issues that I got to deal with.
Hello.
Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades. They're giving you their trial set for free. You just cover $3 worth of shipping. Your trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle. Like I say, one of my favorite parts about it. A five precision engineered blade with lubricating strip and my favorite, the trimmer blade, which I'm trying to lobby them to call it the cedar blade. Rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. And you just get it for the cost of shipping, $3. So to get your free trial set, including the razor, the five blade cartridge, the shave gel, go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, interview I recorded earlier with Dan Frumkin. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program independent journalist Dan Frumkin. You may have read his work at The Intercept, Huffington Post, Washington Post, and many more. Dan, thanks so much for your time today.
Great talking to you, Sam.
All right. Well, let's start. I guess let's start with the semi most recent news, which was last night upon the authority of Rod Rosenstein. He is the Deputy Attorney General. James Comey was fired. In fact, I can't even necessarily parse that out. There were letters from Rod Rosenstein. There was also a letter from Jeff Sessions. Who actually did the firing?
Well, Trump did the firing. Trump is the only person who can do that. The FBI director is appointed for a 10-year term, and normally presidents don't fire them, but they do have the authority to do so.
And my understanding is that Trump sent his own personal bodyguard to deliver the information to FBI headquarters?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like we're living in Paraguay sometimes, doesn't it?
A little bit. What's
interesting is the Rod Rosenstein letter, although it was clearly, you know, it was dated Tuesday, so it was hardly something that he had sent to Trump for Trump to discuss and consider at length. The letter laid out a pretty good case for why Comey should be fired. It was a case that a lot of people made back in July when Comey did something completely unprecedented, which was to actually discuss an ongoing criminal investigation,
right?
Which he has which is completely unprecedented in terms and against all DOJ and FBI rules. So, of course, Comey then went again just before the election and announced that the investigation he had said was closed was now not necessarily closed for even more wildly bogus reasons. You know, a little data point that had come up. So what you have here is Rod Rosenstein describing accurately a rogue FBI chief who was motivated more by self-interest than anything else. He just didn't want to look bad.
Right.
And so he did things that he shouldn't have done purely because he thought, you know, he would look noble or he would look ignoble if he didn't do them. Now, that said, the letter is, you know, is obviously just a pretext. The timing is much clearer. If you'd wanted to fire Comey for what he did back in July or November, you would have fired him back in July and November, or you would have fired him once you took office in January. The only thing that we know happened on Monday is that Sally Yates, the former acting attorney general, went and testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And when she was asked whether she had seen any evidence of collusion between the Trump team and the Russians, whether she could rule out, whether she could declare that she had never seen any evidence, she said, "I can't say that." So what that meant was that the FBI counterintelligence investigation that she had been apprised of until she was fired by Donald Trump had in fact uncovered some evidence suggesting possible collusion between Trump's team and the Russians. Trump hears that on Monday on the TV, you know, according to Politico, he's yelling at the TV, and on Tuesday he fires the FBI chief, thereby quite potentially derailing this investigation.
Now, there's also been reporting, though, that Trump had wanted to do this as early as a week ago, and that Jeff Sessions was trying to develop, a rationale. That seems not inconsistent even with the version of Trump freaking out when he hears Sally Yates and wanting to fire Comey. But
Right. I think it's been an evolving thing for Trump as he learns that the FBI was really getting closer to Flynn. I don't think he necessarily realized until the last few weeks what was going on. And CNN just reported that that they've actually sent out grand jury subpoenas to various associates of Flynn. So the FBI investigation, if anything, is heating up, and of course that would panic Trump.
And what's also interesting about the timing is that there was an ongoing, and like you say, I mean, I happen to be one of those people who felt that James Comey should have been fired because he so clearly broke FBI and Department of Justice policy. You know, I mean, a former friend of mine was a USA, and he said that he actually, you know, sat in some big auditorium where James Comey just pounded on the idea that you never, ever, particularly in the weeks and months before an election, would reveal anything about an investigation one way or another.
I mean, there's two sort of major rules for the FBI. One is you don't talk about ongoing investigations, and two, you don't say anything that could, you know, that could affect an election. And he just waded right into both.
And so, but what was interesting is that there's an ongoing Inspector General investigation of Comey's actions that there was no reason why they couldn't wait for that, right? I mean, that's the official, Ron, I mean, with all due respect to Rosenstein, and, you know, with much less respect to Jeff Sessions, who ostensibly, right, is recused. So it seems that's an interesting recusal. I'm recused from the investigation, but I am going to weigh in on the firing of the chief investigator. But with all due respect to Rosenstein, why wouldn't you wait for the Inspector General's report?
Well, Trump doesn't do that sort of thing. He's impulsive. There's no reason that I could imagine seeing him wait for something to happen that he wants to happen. He wanted this to happen. He made it happen. He, you know, according to various journalistic reports that are out that are, you know, based on anonymous Trump officials, so he'd take them with a big grain of salt, or at least two. You know, he was angry, and he wanted this to happen right away. And I mean, Rosenstein is an interesting character in that he generally had. Was fairly well respected from both, you know, from both ends of the political spectrum, but he got played here at best, and was complicit at worst.
Well, I mean, well, how would he? What is the get played scenario? I mean, you know, walk me through that. I mean, is it that he writes this letter and doesn't thinks that it's just going to be part of a larger portfolio that makes this argument, or
sure. I mean, he may have very reasonably expressed this view to people in the Trump administration before. It's a very reasonable view,
yes,
that Comey totally, you know, broke the rules and was out of line. So somebody might have said, "Okay, I need you to write this up," and he said, "Okay, I'll write it up." I mean, that's the most benign scenario I can come up with.
Right, and then this letter ends up being used as some type of cudgel and justification.
Right, and then Sessions sends it over to Trump, and, you know, I mean, Rosenstein's letter didn't say, "Mr. President, you should fire the FBI director." It just said, "This is a problem."
And which I think a lot of people can agree with. So, all right, let's turn to now what happens next. I think at one point you tweeted out, you know, the key here is to look and see what the Republicans are saying. And I mean, now we're in for all the legal aspects of this, this is really any accountability and any implications to this are wholly a function of politics now, aren't they?
Exactly, and that's why we've been living in this very weird era where there's been no accountability at all, and it's because the congressional Republicans have made it that way. You know, they overcame their concerns with Trump and have become complete lackeys to Trump in almost every conceivable way, and that's why that's where the power is. That's why he's able to do what he's able to do. You know, I think Congressman Jerry Nadler this morning issued a statement saying this is, you know, approaching the constitutional crisis. It's not a constitutional crisis. It's just that Congress won't do its job.
Right.
So the only question, Trump's entire future is a function of when and if the Republicans turn against him. Because until then, he's safe, you know, unless he decides to quit because in a huff, which is always a possibility.
Well, I should say, literally, as we're speaking, the Senate Intelligence Chair, Burr, said that the Comey firing The timing makes people believe that something's being covered up, but it's not life or death, and he is calling for an independent counsel. I mean, walk me through, it doesn't warrant a special prosecutor. Now, that's, people should understand, there's a difference between an independent counsel and a special prosecutor, right? Independent counsel is very independent. A special prosecutor has some independence and its own investigative resources. Walk me through the politics of this and why. I mean, I've heard some people say the Republicans would love to get this out of Congress because otherwise it could muck up the works. And then others say, no, of course, they want to have control over this. I mean, what we're looking at, it seems to me, is just sort of like, it sort of feels like one of those, electric horse race games when you were a kid, where you just put them on there, it turns on, and they just vibrate. And you're just going to see which goes first. Are they going to be able to cut Medicaid in time and give the tax cuts before this thing gets too out of hand, it seems to me, is the race.
No, that's a really good point. I mean, congressional Republicans who at least signed on with Trump because they thought they could achieve their agenda must be a little bit disturbed at how chaotic everything has become. But, you mentioned Richard Burr. He was one of the folks who came out last night with a pretty surprisingly negative statement initially about Comey's firing. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating because it was essentially the first crack in what had been a really pretty pretty amazingly strong Republican wall of support. And I was wondering, gosh, where's this going to go? And the Washington Post actually did a very funny little sort of chart of, showing where Republicans were on this on a, from livid to completely puppy dog. And of course, no one was at livid, but there were quite a few, a handful of people on the angry side. And
Ben Sasse, if I remember correctly,
or
two others.
Yeah. And so I thought that was really interesting because that might end up being the beginning of the end. But then, here you have Burr basically being obviously someone from the White House called him and swatted him. And now he's back in line again.
The president, apparently he spoke to the president this morning.
That would do it. Can you imagine talking to Donald Trump and actually deciding to do what he told you to do? It's just a whole different world. At some point, for one reason or another, the question is, will the Republicans say, we can't manage with this guy anymore? Either because of scandal after scandal, or because, like you said, they're just not able to get what they want done because things keep on getting, distractions keep on arising. And at that point, the irony about impeachment is a political decision. It has nothing to do with whether you've actually done anything wrong on some sort of criminal or objective scale. At some point, they might want to impeach him. At some point, they might want to encourage his cabinet to take him out of office. They would be a lot better off with Pence in a lot of ways.
I think Pence certainly is up their alley, but I also can't help but think that with the absence of this story becomes scrutiny on who in the Senate is actually going to sign on to cutting and destroying Medicaid as we know it, right?
Yeah.
And so I think I don't know if I subscribe to this, but I think the contrarian view is that, this type of thing, as long as you can keep it under control, has the same dynamic of the forces that swept Trump into power in many respects. Like, let's have the sideshow, which looks like the main show. And really, we're going to get a lot of stuff done in the meantime.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, at this, if the House and the Senate tomorrow, voted to destroy Obamacare and cut Medicaid by $3 trillion, it would not be the big headline of the day.
Right.
So they've done a very good job of distracting people from policy.
I've been watching TV now for a couple hours. As far as I can tell, Paul Ryan he's not in the country. He doesn't have any position of authority. This guy's just like another dude. Like he might as well be in retirement. I mean, no one seems to be holding him to account. People forget that Devin Nunes stopped by Paul Ryan's house before he went to the White House in his sort of ill-fated trip. It's pretty amazing. Well, I guess
that could be a major dynamic, because what happens in the House, obviously, it's the House that would act first. And McConnell is obviously out there with both fists swinging for Trump this morning. But yeah, the House dynamics are much more complicated.
Now, let me ask you this. We had Comey, who was so taken aback by the notice that he had been fired, which came from the TV, that he thought it was an elaborate prank. And that suggests to me that, I mean, not just like, wow, I can't believe Donald Trump wouldn't have done this in a more, official and classy way. But it suggests to me, I mean, if we track back and we remember those, that spate of like a week's worth of constant rolling 10:30 at night leaks about Flynn, about Russian connections, which led to Jeff Sessions recusing himself. And then a week or two later, James Comey finally basically addressing the intelligence committees, both for the first time in public, but also in closed session, and conceding that there is an investigation of the president. That suggests to me that he thought that those set of leaks, maybe I'm reading too much into his mind, but he was under the impression that he was protected at that point and shielded, that he was not just surprised at the way that he got fired, but that he was surprised that he got fired. I want you to just give me your sense of that. And then also, are we going to start seeing another sort of cascade of leaks to basically force, you know, a special prosecutor?
Well, first of all, I should point out, he didn't acknowledge there's an investigation of the president. There is an investigation of the president's team.
Right. Okay.
And
fair enough.
Possible Russian collusion. And, you know, just a little asterisk here, I'm not necessarily at all convinced that there was collusion. So I'm absolutely convinced we need to figure this out. But
we need to figure out what the hell's going on.
We need to figure out what the hell's going on. And the Russians did something, right, and the Trump people benefited from it. And if there was, in fact, any collusion, that is an astonishing fact which needs to be uncovered.
Yes, I'd be surprised if there was collusion, and if there was, that there was an awareness that they were colluding. I subscribe much more to a theory of Donald Trump had a lot of friends who were mobsters, and some of them also happened to be Russian assets. Right. That's
and idiots, monsters and idiots. Don't
indeed.
But yes, exactly. I can't imagine that Comey wasn't saying, well, now he can't fire me.
Right.
I mean, how does a president fire somebody who is essentially investigating his people? You know, how I suspect Comey would say that Comey probably thought he was safe. Exactly.
And do you think we're going to see a whole new sort of round of leaks to create the political pressure that would cause? I mean, because we had Chuck Schumer on the floor of the Senate today saying there has to be a special prosecutor, and we need to have closed door sessions with Attorney General Sessions and with Rod Rosenstein. Separate, right? I mean, just it's like the cop pulling someone to the back of the car, asking him questions, and then asking the passenger questions separately as to how this came about. Do you think we're going to see like leaks from?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, what's depressing about the cable coverage is it's all pundit after pundit, and nobody actually giving us any news. What's incumbent upon my profession is to shake out some more news, and obviously to rebut the view from the White House that there's nothing to see here, folks. Just move on. I think reporters will be aggressively trying to get people to explain what's going on. I think that there are now a lot of people who are more motivated than ever to leak, because they realize that loyalty to the president at this point is not all it's cracked up to be.
Well, but do you think Comey was being loyal to the president? I mean, give me your sense of like where track Comey's actions from July until now, from your perspective.
Well, I mean, again, with Comey, I've always been very skeptical of this guy. Well, not always. I supported him back when he resisted the Bush terrorism surveillance program. But since he became considered for FBI director, I realized this was a guy who was really very self-interested, and so he's not partisan. I don't think he's particularly loyal to one party or another or one president or another. But he's always looking out for what's best for Comey, and so in July. I mean, keep in mind, everybody in Washington thought Hillary was going to win, right? Yeah. So in July, he felt like he needed to do this, you know, make this statement, because he felt like it would reflect it badly on the FBI otherwise, and he personally would make the statement look like a hero. That's what he thought. And then when the new information about the FBI, about the Huma emails came out, he panicked, and he said, oh, my God, I'm going to look terrible when Hillary's elected, like I covered up for her. I don't think he thought for a minute that Trump would ever get elected.
Right.
So it's just self-interest all along. No, I don't think that he's been loyal to Trump, and I don't think he's the figure showing that loyalty doesn't work. But I think in general what you're seeing here is that Trump is impulsive, that he is trying to deny reality, and that I think the message to the FBI is, well, let's just let loose.
Well, and to be fair, at least he's consistent. And I would add, my theory for a while about Comey was not just that he was making himself look good. I mean, in October, he thinks that Donald Trump is going to win. He knows that there's an ongoing investigation that now has brought indictments, at least for Flynn, right? Not indictments, excuse me, subpoenas. And he also knew that his president, being Hillary Clinton, or at least he had certainly had reason to believe, her Justice Department may be bringing charges against some of Trump's associates. And remember, Donald Trump had said, I don't know, a week earlier, 2 weeks earlier, if I become president, I'm going to have my people prosecute you. And so that does create a dynamic where you're trying to figure out, like, how can I make sure that if we end up do bringing charges against these people, it doesn't appear like retribution.
And the irony that it was Flynn, one of the people at the convention yelling, lock her up. It's just too much, isn't it?
It is way, way too much, Dan. And I appreciate your taking the time to help us walk through it today. Dan Frumkin, thanks so much. And we'll put a link. What's your Twitter handle?
It's Frumkin, my last name, Froomkin. Come and join the gang.
We will put that in our on the podcast subscription today. Thanks so much, Dan. Awesome. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye-bye.
You take care.
Okay, folks. Next up, we're going to talk to Luke Savage on his piece in Current Affairs. But first, you know, let's just play this clip from Tubin. I thought this was pretty good. And by all accounts, the White House, I think we made this point, but it really does appear the White House thought that people would be psyched about this. They thought, nobody likes Comey. He did do the wrong thing. Maybe nobody will notice that we're 6 months late in doing this. Maybe nobody will notice all the other stuff that's buzzing around about these investigations, and no one will make that point. I mean, it is hard to understand the reasoning here if it doesn't include someone's culpability. I mean, I guess theoretically, hey, we have an excuse to get rid of Comey, so we have our guy in there for the next 3 years or 7 years. But if that was really the case, you might say, well, let's wait for the IG report. Because undoubtedly, that's also going to be critical. Then we'll take the letter that we know we can get from Rod Rosenstein. Or maybe you're concerned about, maybe your buddy Roger Stone is saying you should fire this guy because Roger Stone doesn't want to be investigated because Roger Stone really does feel like he may have some liability. Maybe they're concerned about what they had on Flynn. Maybe Trump's concerned about what they have on Jared or Ivanka. I mean, who knows? But here is Jeffrey Toobin on CNN, not a bomb thrower. He's a former prosecutor himself. Not a bomb thrower, but he seems rather outraged about this and is not hesitating to tell Wolf Blitzer.
Can we point out that the emperor is not wearing any clothes? This memo from Rod Rosenstein says that James Comey was fired for being too mean to Hillary Clinton? Does anyone believe that? Could anyone believe that? I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, suddenly, here it is in May of 2017 that he's being fired for a press conference that he held in July of 2016? I mean, this is just the most preposterous pretext. This is an investigator who is investigating the White House. And he was just fired by the White House. This doesn't happen in the United States, except on October 20th, 1973, when Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox. And if anyone thinks that a new FBI director is going to come in and the agency will just take over and continue their investigation as if this had never happened, that's not how it works. Jeffrey, they will put in a stooge who will shut down this investigation. Well, Jeffrey, they are in charge. The political people are in charge of the FBI, not the street agents. The street agents do what they're told. And now Donald Trump will put in maybe Chris Christie, someone who will do his bidding.
There you have it. And it's going to be interesting to see, to say the least, who their first attempt at appointing is. I'm sure Chris Christie would love that job. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Luke Savage. We're going to totally off topic. But who knew that would come up? So you get with two interviews today, folks. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program a Toronto-based writer, journalist, Luke Savage. He is, you may have seen his work in Jacobin, and we're specifically talking about a piece he did for A Current Affair, How Liberals Fell in Love with the West Wing. Welcome to the program, Luke.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I got to cop to the fact that I only saw one episode of The West Wing, and I actually saw it. I don't actually think I actually saw it as it was presented on television. I was in the audience of the debate between Jimmy, maybe it was Jimmy Smits and
Alan Alda.
And Alan Alda, because my co-host, my former co-host on radio, Janine Garofalo, was then doing The West Wing. And so I went out there and we did our show from out there. And so I never actually even saw the episode, but I saw that scene. And I was never a fan. Nobody in the office is a big fan of The West Wing. But nevertheless, I don't know enough about it, but what you write here resonates. But tell us the gist of what The West Wing reveals about a certain species of political actors in this country. And not literally actors.
Well, I mean, I think that's really the crux of the piece. And I guess the first thing I should say is, you know, the reason that The West Wing is worth writing about in the first place, I mean, it's a little weird to do a piece of, on first viewing, a piece of, you know, TV, what looks like to be TV criticism of something that's been off the air for more than a decade. I mean, the show, the first season was, I think, aired in 1999 during kind of the twilight of the Bill Clinton presidency. But it's really grown to be something a lot more than a TV show. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it's kind of a crucial part of sort of the liberal cultural ecosystem. And, you know, there are several reasons for that, which I guess we'll talk about in the next few minutes. But, you know, the show was, I think, originally meant to be a sort of idealized, almost revisionist rendering of the Clinton presidency, sort of the Clinton presidency without the Lewinsky scandal. Like, here's what could have been. Here's the liberal Camelot that could have been. But, you know, it came to be something more than that. During the Bush era and after 9/11, it became much more like group therapy for Democrats and liberals. And I think in a big way, it informed, you know, when it was their turn to run things again, it informed, you know, their impression for how they should do things and, you know, how politics could be, how it was and how it could be and how it should be. And, you know, that's where we get to kind of the actual politics of the show, which, I mean, I think it's safe to say, you know, the show represents a politics which is very kind of exciting if you're a certain kind of person, which, you know, looks and feels great, but which is pretty hollow of any kind of clear ideological commitment and which sees political success as being much more about kind of how things look and feel, how institutions and processes work, much more than how they're actually used to, you know, do anything. And I think that's kind of the central conceit of the show. And that's ultimately a presentation, a rendering of politics, which I think, you know, anybody with substantive progressive commitments, I mean, I'm a socialist, but you don't have to be a socialist to think this. You know, anybody with kind of substantive progressive commitments, you know, I think needs a little more from their politics and should demand more from it than just, a charismatic, smart president who staffs his administration with, you know, swift-tongued kind of Ivy League people that talk really, really fast and, debate, spend a lot of time debating the intricacies of legislation without actually getting very much done. I think that's the big problem with the show.
What I found really interesting about it was that I was a lot more, or I should say, when I started my sort of, I guess, professional left career as it were.
Right.
It was just as this sort of what we then called the blogosphere was growing, and all of your descriptions of the type of politics in there, that it's really about, you know, sort of that the highest value is the ability for people to go and have a drink after they've debated this stuff. And the sort of very serious people things. This was the primary line of demarcation in politics during the 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006 era was people who resented, even though they weren't necessarily, you know, the politics was, there was not a lot of people who were referring to themselves as socialists in that era. It was simply saying, like, we've got to do something. Like, even to be just a sort of a mainline Democrat, you need to do something. It's not about maintaining civility process. It is about actually achieving some goals. I mean, at that point, it was all about you can lose and still gain in the losing. And that was the primary argument. And so I think that was like the lived reality of the Democratic Party at that time. I wasn't conscious of it as emanating from the show. What also strikes me in terms of its salience today is, I don't know if you know this, but Lawrence O'Donnell was one of the EPs and writers for that show.
Right, right.
And much of like the narratives that come, this is the second highest rated show on MSNBC on a regular basis. Much of those narratives sort of still play out there. He came from that era of like Tip O'Neill would go and have a drink with the Gipper. And leave it on the playing field, but talk more about that exactly. You know, like what was the message? Like what were the aspirations of politics expressed in that show?
So I guess first, just as a quick comment, I think it's interesting hearing your kind of blogosphere story. I think it's very difficult to extricate, or rather, to kind of parse. To what extent the West Wing has actually directly informed liberal sensibilities, and to what sense it's merely kind of reflecting and channeling them. It's pretty difficult. But I do think, as someone put it on the recent bonus episode of Chapo Trap House, it really is the kind of Rosetta Stone for decoding a lot of the fallacies of liberalism today, and especially during the Obama administration. So, let's talk about those fallacies. First of all, there's this kind of debate club ethos that you mentioned, this idea that fundamentally politics is about respectability. It's about respectable, smart interlocutors conversing as respectfully as possible and then leaving it all on the field afterwards. And there's a few ways to think about this, but I guess first, we should talk about what's obviously wrong with this view of politics, which is that it essentially rids politics of all those awful politics. If fundamentally what you're about is celebrating the discourse, you're replacing ideology with etiquette. You're replacing values with process. So that's not, I don't know what you're doing there, but you're not doing politics. Politics is not about, a bunch of smart people respectfully disagreeing. It's about clashing values, clashing interests. It's about power. It's about fundamental disagreements about how human society and human community should collectively organize their institutions. And I think, it's important to register the extent to which, like, this didn't come from nowhere, this sort of debate club model of thinking about politics, this kind of taxonomy of smart and dumb, which is also something you see a lot on kind of late night comedy and TV. It's the way a lot of people see politics these days. As Emmett Renson detailed in that great essay of his, which rather hilariously was for Vox, the smug style in American liberalism. But I think that this debate club model for thinking about politics really mirrors a shift in the social base of the Democratic Party and of American liberalism for the past 30 or 40 years. I mean, the Democratic Party, you know, its kind of leading figures now are much more likely, and its social base, and to some extent its electoral base, much more likely to be incubated in kind of the Ivy League, in, you know, the Yale law, you know, law review, in Harvard Debating Society, whatever, this kind of Oxford Union style of doing things, much more, that's, you know, where the Democratic Party is much more kind of psychologically and sociologically and ideologically rooted. It's, and you know, when politics is, you know, when the leading figures in politics are the product of that sort of upper middle class milieu, you know, it's not a surprise that they don't really see politics in terms of, you know, they don't see it as kind of a real struggle. Because for them, I mean, if you're materially comfortable and you have some, you know, measure of kind of social status, you know, you're much more likely, you know, struggle for you means struggling for more prestige against people of your same social class, right? It's not about, you know, we either win this or I don't make enough to feed my family.
Right.
You know, this is what happens when you incubate politics in places where people don't know what struggle is, rather than on picket lines or in union halls or civil rights rallies or the kinds of places that used to at least partly inform Democratic Party politics and the kind of liberalism that it channeled.
There's a couple of things I want to touch on, and maybe where some of the origins of that started. But let me ask you this, which sort of dogs me in various contexts. When you say, and I agree with this, and this I think is fairly makes common sense. I mean, when you incubate politics, as you said, in one context versus another, you're going to get a different sort of politics. If you incubate politics within the context of sort of a more academic, for lack of a better description, setting, you call it debate club, but I think you know, we see that in numerous ways that I have been throughout the past 15 years exposed to people who are hesitant to make a broader political point because of small technicalities that they know within their world will gain them more currency than actually winning the battle itself. And you say, you put that in opposition to the idea of incubating politics in an area where in Detroit, let's say, where people have lost their jobs and they have lost infrastructure and they're getting constantly under constant assault from their government. But who is the you? Who, I mean, this is, you know, this is one of the things that I think is has been dogging me in some respects, is who is the you and in this scenario? When you say you incubate, because I obviously you're not talking to me, but I'm saying
No.
Who is the you, and why would they, whoever the you is, why would they do anything that wasn't in their interest anyways? I mean, I know it's, you're just using it as a way of explaining it, but I mean, I think like this is, it's essentially, there was in some respects a change in the Democratic leadership in some respects.
Oh yeah, in a big way. There's a great piece in a few Jacobin issues back called Atari Democrats by Lily Geismer that details this process. But I mean, basically,
and I should say people can go back. I think we've interviewed Lily twice on this about the ascendance of a liberal elite that it was more sort of founded in the, I guess, the professional class, particularly the technical class. But go ahead.
So that was kind of the rupture. What she detailed is, you know, the rupture of this this kind of New Deal coalition, and the way that Bill Clinton especially forged a different kind of coalition that was much more managerial and technocratically minded, was much more based in these kind of white collar constituencies. So as she says, you know, in her piece, it's often argued that Democrats have abandoned class politics, but that's not actually what's occurred. The Democrats have just traded one kind of class politics, one which at least was somewhat rooted in kind of the working class politics of the New Deal and of civil rights, for a different kind of class politics, which puts in place the values and interests of new economy professionals. And, you know, their politics are the politics of, you know, what we often call the third way. And the West Wing, I think, does a better job. It's kind of, you know, inadvertently a meta commentary on the kind of values and affect of the people that believe, the class of people that have been kind of ascendant in American liberalism since this shift occurred. And I guess just one more point on the debating question. I mean, you really see this playing out you saw it playing out during the 2016 election cycle in a huge way. And you also saw accordingly how ineffective it is, and what an inadequate narrow view of politics it represents. You had so many there. I can't count the number of times that I read on social media, like the morning after an episode of The Daily Show or whatever, that Donald Trump had been totally destroyed. He was totally destroyed so many times, and yet somehow he was still standing. Now, Ezra Klein, you know, who came up through the very blogosphere that you mentioned, he did these write-ups on the Clinton-Trump debates where he just, you know, he was just adamant that Hillary Clinton had won the debate. And, you know, maybe it's true that Hillary Clinton did win the debates. And, I mean, she's a lot more articulate than Donald Trump, obviously. Maybe it's true she won them in kind of a, you know, on pure points. But, you know, the electorate isn't, you know, it's not the entire electorate doesn't operate on the principles of like the water cooler talk at the offices at Vox.com. You know, people are much more guided by their values and by their emotions and by, you know, the ways that they think the political class isn't meeting their needs. They're much more guided by that than they are by, what somebody's resume is, or whether somebody wins a debate. You know, politics is not ultimately a competition of who has the most impressive LinkedIn profile or who wins the debates on points. If it was, Hillary Clinton would have won more than 400 electoral votes, I'm sure.
And I will say, I mean, just not to be too technocratic myself, but Ezra Klein was a little bit more institutional even back then than what was going on. He was at the American Prospect very quickly. He may have had
right.
Exactly. I don't.
I don't.
I'm being
I
a little
saw
picky.
It. Hello?
But I want to get back also to this origin, because as we talk, and particularly on this particular day, right, where the parallels seem to be appropriate with Watergate. While what Lily Geismer has written about was taking place, and others have written about it in the context of McGovern's, both of the changes to the Democratic nominating process, which actually may have made it more democratized, but also disempowered labor as a, you know, particular function of McGovern's dislike of a couple of unions. While that was happening, in some ways around that same era, you have Watergate, where much of, it seems to me, the left's energy was subsumed by, and I don't know, but with perfectly understandable reason, by the horror of a president who really was unethical and lawbreaking, and and that good government became an ascendant value in some respects because of the abuses we saw under Nixon, ranging from COINTELPRO through to his own sort of illegal activity or marshaling of illegal activity. And in some respects, we're seeing that same dynamic play out again, you know? And to a certain extent, it's inevitable. There's a certain inevitability to it, where it's like, look, you know, we were going to have you first, but we bumped you because the president fired the guy who's investigating him. And we don't, you know, or, you know, his entourage. And it would be ridiculous under any circumstances not to to cover that. And it would also be ridiculous, it seems to me, to not use it. Right. Because so, you know, I mean, so the idea of civility and process and all of that, it's not a question of whether it should be none of that. It's a question of what should be the primary function of politics. But there are times where use this to achieve the other. It's just that in some instances, people are using this to achieve what they're using.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree at all, and I mean, I think that your point about Watergate is a really good one. I mean, but I do think that there's a major risk in, you know, developing an oppositional politics that is just about, you know, this predominantly focused with focused on kind of the, you know, etiquette and even just, you know, personal ethics
and not or even just criminality. I mean,
criminality. Yeah. But I mean, you saw it during the George Bush era where, you know, Obama replaced George Bush and, you know, did in many ways represent a break from George Bush, but, you know, was able to carry on, you know, a lot of the same things, sometimes in different ways. And nobody noticed because so much of the focus had been on this single figure who they're now rehabilitating in the face of Trump, you know, and his, you know, his incompetence, especially. And I mean, I think, you know, government will always be any kind of government that's, you know, able to implement the kinds of things that political progressives would like to see is always going to be incredibly complicated. It's going to need to be staffed by intelligent and competent people, but it's also going to need to be a place where people are brought together, not by just the sensation of doing process and by the sensation of, you know, things, looking good in kind of a white collar way. You know, it's people are going to need to be brought together by something more substantive than just etiquette and norms and traditions. Otherwise, American liberalism is basically just going to be indistinguishable from like English Toryism. You know, it's just going to be about, I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this kind of West Wing ethos really mirrors the conservative intellectual Michael Oakeshott's definition of what conservatism is, which is, you know, an idea. Well, it's not an ideology even. It's just, it's a way of, it's a mode of governing where you govern by intimation. You don't govern by steering the ship in it to any particular harbor. You just keep the ship steady and on an even keel. And I think as long as that is the barometer, that is the metric by which liberals conceive of politics, they're not only going to fail to implement even the thinnest kind of progressive agenda, but they're going to keep losing because it's not effective as an oppositional tool. You saw with Hillary Clinton, and I think, you know, and she in many ways is, I think, the superlative embodiment in some ways of this kind of politics, along with Obama in another sense. You saw how ineffective this was against Donald Trump and all these times that liberals thought that he'd been absolutely owned. They were completely wrong.
I mean, I think I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, but let me push back a little bit because Obama, it seems to me, was really the quintessential, sort of West Wing president. I mean, I happen to think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I happen to think, though, I mean, you know, we see at least, you know, and it may be too incremental, but we see at least the value of, I would say, the PP part of the PPACA, but we see the value of those things now in retrospect. But, I mean, here's the point. Obama would have destroyed Donald Trump. And Obama did destroy, largely speaking, two Republican candidates. And I mean, where I do think that Clinton made a tactical and strategic error. I mean, this is putting aside my reservations about her in terms of her politics. But I mean, if we're talking about in the realm of winning, okay, just let's keep it on that superficial level of actually gaining power. I do think that it was a mistake for her to sort of try and battle it out on sort of a personal resume playing field, not because her resume wasn't better than Donald Trump's, but as soon as it became about personalities, this guy is, you know, is a road comic and he's gonna do some damage to her. And had it been in the policy realm, I think he would have been in much trickier waters. I mean, if she had just run on the policy she had adopted from Bernie Sanders and made that but with all that said, if the idea is to win, right? I mean, and this is the argument, I see on a daily basis what drives, you know, I have a certain baseline size of my audience and I see what drives. And I know I can tell you today. And, you know, the day's not over, but I know today is going to be the highest download day that we've had in a couple of weeks. And it's going to be because there is a huge amount of people out there who, for them, politics are, you know, and I think this is an element of liberalism, not of the Democratic establishment, but of what is inside people. That they want politics to work in the way that it's supposed to work, whatever that is.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm going to be a liberal, which means that I have interests outside of politics, and I'm only going to basically come when there's a crisis. And so in that respect, making Donald Trump a crisis, just putting aside whether or not he is or isn't, but making him a crisis is probably the best chance for Democrats to take over in 2018. That said, if they don't have an agenda, they're not going to hold on to power for very long. I mean, long term, they're going to lose.
Yeah, I mean, I think Donald Trump is a crisis. And I mean, I certainly would never suggest that the Democrats like not talk about Donald Trump or that, you know, opponents to Trumpism ignore him. Obviously, the firing of the FBI director is a major story, and there are a lot of questions that need to be asked about it. But I think the point about going back to the West Wing, I think the point about it is even if you do win on these terms, if you make your guiding principles, I mean, you get somebody like Obama. I agree with you. I think that Obama is really more than Hillary Clinton is. I think Hillary Clinton is evidence of kind of the hollowness and ineffectuality of this kind of politics, but Obama is really its kind of superlative embodiment. You know, Democrats get a politician like Obama who's a uniquely gifted communicator, who's very charming and charismatic, who has an inspiring personal story, and they can win political power. But as that was happening, as Obama won pretty handily two presidential elections, they were losing, hundreds and hundreds of seats. They were at the right. state level. They were losing 12 governorships. They were losing control of Congress. The actual political power beyond kind of the symbolic power of having a president in office who, even when he had control of both houses of Congress, was unable to implement any kind of ambitious legislative program. If you make the guiding principles of politics, if you foreground, I should say, if you make primary and predominant, the celebration of process, you're going to get, office without power. You're going to get victories that are very, very hollow. With Obama, I think it's very telling that, you had this beautiful family in the White House, this incredibly popular president who had a majority of Americans, I think it's safe to say, were quite fond of. And at the same time, you had the withering of liberalism as a political force yeah. directly in tandem with that. And you had a period of, where millions of Americans were sinking into further despair and alienation and frustration with the political class, such that the candidacy of someone like Donald Trump became possible. So I think it's important for people to look beyond the short-termism of who won a debate or who won an election cycle or even who won the presidency, because it's that kind of thinking, taken as kind of a totality is, I think, a big part of what's taken Democrats to really their worst nadir in about 100 years in terms of the actual political power and influence they wield in shaping the lives of people in the United States.
Indeed. Luke Savage, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it. And thank you even more for watching that program,
yeah.
So that we did not have to.
Next up, legwork right there.
Next up, we're going to ask you to watch all three seasons of Newsroom, ooh. And then come
how
back
much
and report.
Will you pay me?
I would never
God.
Wish that.
I don't
Luke.
Think I have enough money, frankly.
Yeah, no, that's a lot.
Maybe we can do a GoFundMe and get you to do that. But I mean, it's interesting to me that I have to say, it's interesting to me that the Newsroom didn't catch on like the West Wing. Maybe that was a function of people just aren't willing to sort of like, they don't care as much about, they don't have fantasies about how their press works as opposed yeah. to having fantasies about how their president works. But
I think I got to about the second or third scene in the Newsroom before I switched it off. It's like almost impossible to watch.
It
opening
really...
credits. It's literally impossible. And also the other thing too, that it everything, and it's not as if there isn't everything you already need to know about Frank Luntz, but the fact that Frank Luntz, that show was like a spiritual solace for him while he ate spaghetti bolognese. Yeah.
Oh,
that guy clearly. I mean, actually, when I read that, I was like, maybe this is better than him being the guy in Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
But it was very disturbing.
All right. Well, either way, Luke Savage, thanks so much. We will link to your piece, How Liberals Fell in Love with the West Wing in Current Affairs. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye.
Well, folks. How's that for a day?
The only way that Sam would like the West Wing is if a lesbian was president. Zing.
God. I do remember free booze, though, at that thing.
That show is
well, we were sitting
bad.
In, we were the audience of the debate. And then afterwards, they had booze. I don't know if that was just for like people who were visiting. I think maybe it was for like because they invited friends and family to sit in the thing.
What kind of booze? Was it fully stocked?
I can't remember. I can't remember.
They didn't do like politically themed drinks, did they?
Now, I can't remember. This is also before Ron Silver passed away. Janine was on the show with Ron Silver, and Ron Silver was one of my early political nemesis. Because during
Wait,
the run
the
up to the war,
poor man's Al Pacino.
Yes.
Is that who that guy is?
Well, he's dead.
Oh,
so he's like,
oh.
he's
oh.
like
Sorry.
The completely
Sorry.
Destitute man.
Sorry, Ron. Didn't mean to insult you, seeing that you're all dead and everything.
Well, I mean, he was not, in my estimation,
destitute Al Pacino,
a good guy. And I'm not saying you should dance on his grave. But I think
I would have to know where his grave was in order to dance on it, Sam.
I don't dance on anybody's grave. But I mean,
Matt,
I think just
Drake,
doing maybe a little like
Matt Drake
Tai Chi type of thing or something like that on his grave.
A little push hands.
Yeah,
on
I mean,
his
I
grave.
Would, you know, like maybe just a little
oh,
bit
dude.
Of popping.
If
or
you can tell me where he is, I'll do some yoga on his
but,
grave.
And he was on that program. It was a very strange time. I mean, I think what strikes me about Luke's perspective is, I mean, I think my personal feeling is that the West Wing was not a template for liberals, even though you just got a, you got a DM for a guy who used to work at Third Way. Hallways were designed to foster the hallway conversations like in the West Wing.
Yep.
I don't think it was a template. I do think it was a reflection of, I mean, really, and this makes total sense, right, when you think about it. I mean, look at the Venn diagram of the politicos who would end up working, writing, and consulting on that show. And then you get a notion of what it was. I mean, it's people who were in politics and could make that transition into entertainment so seamlessly that, and particularly in that era, and that type of entertainment, it gives you a notion of sort of who were there, and they were a reflection of the politics. I mean, Bill Clinton was extremely attracted to Hollywood.
The other thing, though, that's odd about the show, and I only watched, I think, the first two seasons of The West Wing. And I got burned out on it even then.
Two but seasons. There, wow.
How many seasons were there? There were like 10
I don't know.
Seasons,
like
right?
44 episodes.
It's not. Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. Even that was quite a chunk. But
I mean,
anyways.
I went through Battlestar Galactica twice. That was 76 episodes
I'm
each
sure
pass.
Significantly
and that show is one of the greatest
quality.
Show in
yeah.
the history of.
I every second that I spent watching West Wing, I should have been watching Battlestar Galactica or like The Sopranos for the fifth time. But the other thing about the show that is very reflective in some ways of Obama is like it's the Martin Sheen character is he's Bill Clinton like because he's kind of a credentialed professional neoliberal, but it's also and I don't know if a show that was of the kind of liberal elite zeitgeist could be as pro-religion as that show was. But he was also counterbalanced by like basically was like this is Bill Clinton if Bill Clinton could like control his urges. Or maybe
right.
didn't have urges.
Well, that was also
so there was
an era
this,
in
like,
television. I mean, you have to understand,
he's like
too.
A Catholic. He's very moral. He never steps out of line. Maybe humorously he does, but not really.
But the television at that time, too, was also different. Because
right.
there was no, there was only HBO. And HBO was not what it what it has become even then. There is no, there was no. Television starting in the early aughts, maybe even the late aughts, really only in the past, like, little, close to about a decade now, a little bit less, started getting into, like, characters that were not good being the leads, right? And
right,
so you
right,
couldn't,
right, right.
I mean, today you could imagine a West Wing where you have a very flawed, well, it's very easy to imagine a presidency with a very flawed president.
Totally duple.
But where you could actually have a show like that. But all right, whatever. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. It's going to be a little bit truncated today. But nevertheless, folks, it is your support that keeps this program going. Our YouTube channel is, you know, it's just sort of like floating. It's just sort of floating. Now it's like a buoy. It used to be like a ship. Now it's like a buoy. And your support makes this show possible. When you become a member, you support the free half of the program, and then as a way of saying thank you, we give you the fun half of the program. Which is not to say that the first half isn't fun, but the funner half. So go to jointhemajorityreport.com, become a member today. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you buy your stuff through jet.com or amazon.com, do it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Just click on the link. You can purchase all sorts of things, consumer goods, at these links, and do so at your leisure. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.